Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Jim Papandrea, someone who we've had on twice before talking about patristic exegesis and the end of the world. Fortunately, the end of the world has not come upon us, so that means we are free to talk to him once more, and this time about his new book co-authored with Mike Aquilina entitled Seven Revolutions, How Christianity Changed the World and Can Change It Again. In addition to writing that book, Jim is an associate professor of church history at Garrett Evangelical Seminary at Northwestern University and has a few other books to his name, including Reading the Early Church Fathers, The Wedding of the Lamb, and Trinity 101, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, to name just a few. But that's not all he does, because Professor Papandrea is also an accomplished musician, having recorded an album entitled Still Quiet Voice. He maintains his own YouTube channel, as well as having a number of photos of himself on the internet pointing at things in Rome. So this guy is truly multimedia. We will link to his books, personal website, music, and YouTube channel for those of you who want to see and hear what he is all about. And please do check out that CD, because it is filled with some nice spiritually enriching tunes. And as always, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Log in, love us, and we will love you back. Jim, welcome once again to Research on Religion.
Thanks. It's great to be back. I really appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
I'm glad to have you back, because you've been one of my favorite guests on this program as we approach 250 episodes. So it was a real great pleasure to find out that you have a new book. However, full disclosure here, I should note that I knew you would have a new book coming out because you sent me an early draft and I looked at some of the chapters and I provided some feedback to you. And when the actual physical hard copy arrived in my mailbox, I was so excited. I opened it up to the acknowledgement section and then I read down there. And you know what I found? It said that you were thanking, quote, friends and colleagues who read our work and gave us good counsel. You know who you are, unquote. You know, here's my chance for fame and glory to be mentioned in your book, to have my name in there, and then I'm just remain anonymous. So what gives about that?
Well, first of all, let me say congratulations on 250 episodes. That's great. And as far as the dedication, I'm going to have to play the "this was my first experience co-writing a book" card. But I did write in the inscription that I wrote to you. I said, "Tony, this means you." And so you know what you should do is you should take a picture of that page where I signed the book for you and post it on Facebook so everyone can see it.
That's a good idea, because what I was going to suggest is that you track down every book that you sell and then write that in the front cover.
I'll do that too.
Okay. I give so much, but I ask so little, you know? So,
okay.
Actually, let's go ahead and dive right into this book. And all kidding aside, I do want to mention that this was a very good read. And I always recommend the books that we feature here on the program. But I do really want to put this one at the top of the list, because it is very reminiscent of the books that one of my favorite academic heroes writes. That's Rodney Stark. Your book has a vibe that's very similar to his book, The Rise of Christianity. It's very accessible, yet it deals with serious history and serious and academic and moral themes that really resonate with our daily lives today. So I want to congratulate you on a really, really well-written book. I breezed through it really quick and couldn't put it down.
I take that as a huge compliment, because Rodney Stark happens to be one of my academic heroes as well. And so if it had that feel, I appreciate that. Thanks.
Sounds good. So give our ideas the general thrust of the book before we dive into some of the details. What's it all about?
Well, the point of the book is that Christianity changed the way the world thinks about some very important concepts, including, you know, the very identity around what it means to be a human being. And there are many ways in which Christianity revolutionized our worldview, We picked seven of these revolutions, or seven gifts that the church gave to the world. And when you put them all together, they sort of fall into these categories of human rights, improved quality of life, and freedom, especially religious freedom. And, you know, one of the things that really comes out when you read the book is that if you can think of the worst sins that you can imagine, all of these things were absolutely acceptable and business as usual in the world before Christianity came along and changed the way the world thinks about them.
Yeah, and the book reads that way, and which is really kind of neat because it does have this aspect where you wrap it around to conventional times too, and take up some heady issues about things we might be heading into, things that are so quote unquote resurrecting themselves from possibly the pre-Christian era, and we'll talk a little bit more about that kind of stuff. But you mentioned just a moment ago that this was your first foray into co-authoring a book, and you did it with Mike Aquilina. Who is this guy, and how'd you get involved with writing the book with him?
Well, Mike has a journalism background, and he back in the day wrote a lot about Catholicism, the Catholic Church, Rome, and the Vatican, and then he got interested in the Church Fathers. And so he's written a lot of books about the Church Fathers and the early church, and so you can see that's an area where we sort of connected. We first met at a conference, and since then we've done conferences together, and we just become fast friends. And of course, the fact that we're both Italian doesn't hurt. And so when we first started talking about this book, we were originally going to write a book about Constantine and the Edict of Milan, which granted to the empire freedom of religion in the year 313. And the idea was to publish a book in 2013 for the 1700th anniversary of the Edict of Milan. And in the process of doing that, the book expanded and grew so that it was not about one revolution, but seven revolutions that the church gave the world.
Now that you mention it was the 1700th anniversary of the Edict of Milan, I completely forgot to send Constantine a cake.
Yeah, that's right.
flew by me. So, very good. Yeah, it does expand to seven revolutions, as you say. You mentioned one, which was the freedom of religion or religious liberty that we're going to get to. What are the other seven revolutions, briefly?
Well, they sort of work in concentric circles, working out from the individual. So the revolution of the person is that the church converted the world to seeing that all people are created in the image of God, all people are created equal, and therefore no one is expendable. No person is disposable. Then the revolution of the home is a conversion of the world to seeing the home and the family as a place of safety where women and children are not to be exploited, and where married partners are seen as partners. A revolution of the workplace or labor, people are not property, and labor has a dignity to it. The church converted the world to seeing the dignity of labor as opposed to seeing labor as something that was beneath the so-called better people of society. A revolution of religion itself. Now, of course, we inherited monotheism from our Jewish brothers and sisters, but the Christianity defined monotheism specifically as Trinitarian, and then went further and said, not only is God one, but God is love. And that was new to the world. And then a revolution of community. If God is love, then love your neighbor. And by the way, everyone is your neighbor. And we're even supposed to love our enemies. A revolution of the way that people saw death and dying was to, first of all, not fear death, but also not turn it into entertainment as they did in the Roman Empire. And then finally, a revolution of the state or government itself, in which leaders should be seen as servants and in which people have religious freedom to worship and practice their faith according to their conscience.
Okay, so those are the seven. We're going to address probably not all of them today, but we'll address some of them. But one of the other things that you do in this book, you have the seven revolutions, but you set up bookends in a kind of way where you start with the world, what it looked like in the pre-Christian era, and then you talk about Christianity's influence, what would some call the post-Christian era today, and you draw a number of fascinating parallels there. Let's hold off on the post-Christian era until the end of our talk and talk about the pre-Christian era. What does that pre-Christian era mean, and what was it like in a sociological and spiritual sense?
Well, you know, first of all, just to clarify, when we talk about the pre-Christian era, we're not only talking about the time before Christianity, but we're talking about the time before Christianity was legalized. So in a pre-Christian world, there are a couple of centuries of the early Roman Empire in which Christianity existed, and Christians lived in this pre-Christian world because the church had not converted the empire yet. And so on the one hand, you know, the pre-Christian world is a world in which, you know, violence is a form of entertainment, pornography is visible everywhere, people are considered disposable. It is not, you know, not only in the sense of infanticide and abortion, but also in the sense of making death a sport in the arenas with the gladiator games and with public executions. It's a world in which there really is no real freedom in the way we think of it, certainly not freedom of religion, but freedom then was a privilege of the wealthy. The 1% bought their freedom, and the rest of the world couldn't afford it. And so working for a living was considered beneath the 1%. It was considered a low station in life. And so when Christianity comes into the world, from the very beginning, the church critiques these aspects of the culture. And so one of the things that we find is that in the pre-Christian world, Christianity was countercultural. And Christianity critiques the pagan culture, and of course Christians and non-Christians criticized each other, which resulted in Christianity being seen as antisocial and being persecuted. And so it results in the persecution of Christianity.
And you did have another religion at this time, and that's the religion of the Israelis, the Judaism, and that's a forefather of Christianity. So there was, you know, in some respect, some monotheism out there. There was a strong moral code, at least in some part of the Roman Empire. What did Christianity add to this mix that Judaism was not already providing? And why wasn't Judaism spreading as much as Christianity? Why didn't it have the effect on the Roman Empire that Christianity did? I guess this moves us into one of the seven revolutions that you talk about, and that is the revolution of religion. And I think that would be a good place to start. So tell us about the revolution of religion that takes place within the Roman Empire at this time.
Right. Well, of course, Christianity owes a lot to Judaism, and the first Christians were all Jews, and so the foundation of Christianity is, of course, in Judaism. Judaism told us that God is one, but Christianity came along and told us that God is love, and that was sort of an advance on the Jewish way of thinking. And in the Old Testament Judaism especially, the Jews were meant to be separate, to keep themselves separate from the world. In the New Testament, Christianity says, go out and convert the world. So there are some differences, obviously, of course, between Judaism and Christianity, but then even beyond the internal differences is the major difference of Christianity being, you know, what we might call an evangelistic religion. In other words, a religion in which it is built into the religion to go out, engage the world, encounter people, have relationships with people, and introduce people to the faith and spread the faith and convert the world.
And this was in a time when paganism was pretty dominant. So you had Judaism had an influence in the region, but also paganism at this period of time. You mentioned that this was countercultural. Why wasn't this just absorbed into the regular pantheon of pagan gods and just say, oh yeah, here's another one that comes along? Is there anything that really shakes up the spiritual landscape of the Roman Empire at this time?
Well, you know, yes. I mean, if Christianity had simply said, hey, we have this additional god that you can add to your pantheon, people would have done that and probably wouldn't have made as much of an impact. But Christianity was an exclusive religion in the sense that if you commit to the Christian god, you have to quit worshiping the other gods. And that was seen as antisocial. In fact, the early Christians were actually called atheists by the Romans because they only had one God. It was like they didn't have enough religion. They only had one God, so they were called atheists. And of course, the Jews did the same thing, but the Jews didn't convert as many other people to this exclusive religion of one God only. And so when the Christians started refusing to participate in the traditional religions and the imperial cult, that was seen as being unpatriotic. And so patriotism came to be associated with the traditional Greco-Roman deities, and especially worshiping the emperor or worshiping in honor of the emperor. And so patriotism itself came to be seen as opposed to Christianity. And that feeling escalated throughout the first few centuries of the church until it just became an assumption of the Romans that to be a Christian was to be guilty of treason. And treason, of course, is always a crime punishable by death.
And I can imagine they're not going to be lovingly embraced during these first 300 years or so. Now, you're preaching God is love to a culture that you said really embraces death in many odd types of forms that we would think about today, but also out there, you know, proselytizing it. They're growing over time, not just, you know, 12 guys and somebody leading them. Now it's, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, and this movement's going to be building as it's proselytizing. So how did the state deal with these folks?
Well, I mean, first by trying to suppress it, but then eventually by creating a sort of litmus test of patriotism by demanding that everyone sacrifice to the Roman gods in honor of the emperor. And, you know, by the middle of the 3rd century, that became law that you had to do that. And if you did it, you got a receipt. And you could be asked to show your receipt at any time. And if you didn't, you were guilty of treason. And so the Christians were faced with a real choice of either, you know, commit what they considered idolatry and apostasy by sacrificing to the pagan gods and denying Christ if they were asked to do that as well. And then, or the choice was then either do that or face possible arrest, torture, and execution.
A receipt. This is the first time I've heard about this. I'm trying to imagine what that would be like walking around with a receipt. Today, it's pretty easy. You think you get something at the gas station and it scrolls out of the pumps, or they hand it to you at the cashiers at the grocery store and you're carrying this little piece of paper around. But, I mean, paper was not a big, huge commodity back then. Were they carrying around stone tablets? That's it?
No, it actually was. We actually have a few of them.
Wow.
In fact, there's one. The library at the University of Wisconsin-Madison has one that I've seen. The writing is almost illegible now, but imagine a piece of papyrus about, you know, the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that would have said on it, you know, I fill in your name, having always sacrificed to the gods faithfully, do now on this day in the sight of these witnesses, make the required sacrifice, and, you know, sign with an X, and signatures of committee, you know, whoever witnessed it, and fold it up into quarters, and you got your little, it was called a libellus.
Mm-hmm. And that's just absolutely fascinating. I had never known that. I'm going to have to go see one of those things, or maybe look it up on the internet. Maybe we can put up a picture of one of these things on our Facebook page. So if you're not carrying one of these things around, it's not going to be good for you. And if you especially say, well, I'm not carrying it around because I'm a Christian, that's going to be even worse, because the cover of your book actually has a picture of what would happen to you then if you were caught without one of these and declaring you were a Christian. And I guess this kind of feeds into the whole celebration of violence during this period of time. So what does happen?
Well, it depends. You know, I mean, in the Roman Empire, the trend tends to be the farther from Rome you live, the more diverse the enforcement might be. So you might live in a town where the leaders of that town just don't really care to enforce the law. As long as you keep the peace, you know, you can go about your business as a Christian and not really run into trouble. But you might live in another area where they are enforcing the law. And so it really just depends. I mean, if a person was arrested and accused of being a Christian, they would be asked, are you a Christian? If they said no, then they might be asked to curse Christ or something to prove it, and then they would be set free to go on their way. If the person admitted to being a Christian and would not deny the faith, then they certainly could be imprisoned. They could be tortured until they did deny the faith, or they could be executed. And execution could take many forms back then, but executions are almost always public in the arena. Maybe they would be thrown to the lions, you know, just like the traditional picture shows. Maybe they would be crucified. Maybe they would be sent in to fight a gladiator, any number of things. I mean, they actually had a whole array of animals that you could face in the arena that would kill you if you were sentenced to death. And some of the texts even mention ostriches. I don't know what it's like to get killed by an ostrich, but that was there. That was a possibility.
That would be a very slow and humiliating death.
Humiliation is definitely intentionally a part of the picture, and even with crucifixion as well. I mean, these deaths are meant to be humiliating because they're meant to be a deterrent to crime and to dissension. The fact that, you know, people watch this as entertainment, you can see how people would be afraid to cross the wrong people.
Yeah, and this is going to feed into some of the other revolutions that you talk about. And you mentioned early on that you worked them in concentric circles, starting at the individual and moving outward. I want to disrupt that concentric circle arrangement here a little bit and talk about the government, because this is one of the chapters that you were responsible for, one of the ones that I read and one of the ones I'm very interested in. And it blends very easily with what we're talking about here, as you have roughly 300 years of persecutions that the church is battered, beaten, considered to be illegitimate and illegal. But then comes the revolution of the state. What happens here in that one of seven revolutions?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to remember is that Roman culture was not religiously tolerant. We have this idea that there were, you know, all of these gods to be worshipped and all of these cults, which in a way is true, but there were certain rules, and if you didn't keep up with what people considered, you know, basic patriotism in terms of worshiping in the honor of the emperor and worshiping the state gods, you could get into trouble. And so several cults did, and Christianity was one of the persecuted religions. When Constantine comes on the scene, and he then self-identifies as a Christian when he takes over the western part of the empire, there's a lot of mythology surrounding Constantine, that he made Christianity the official religion of the empire and turned the tables on the persecutors, and really none of that is true. Constantine did not make Christianity the official religion of the empire. What he did was he issued the Edict of Milan in 313, which gave freedom of worship for everyone. And you can tell he is going to privilege the church and Christianity. So Christianity will be have a privileged position in the empire, but it will not be the only legal religion. Paganism is not outlawed, and the tables are not turned. The former persecutors do not become immediately persecuted. What Constantine wanted to do was make peace, unite the empire, and so he grants freedom of religion for everyone, which is, to my knowledge, the first time that had ever been done in the world.
Yeah, and I want to address that myth a little bit, because earlier in my career, I did have the myth that Edict of Milan meant state endorsement of religion. And it really is a leveling of the playing field to basically say, okay, stop persecuting the Christians. There was a huge, I think it was the Decian or Diocletian persecution that just basically led up to this. So there was a very intense persecution in the decade before the Edict of Milan. But in terms of another, I mean, you're looking back in Roman times, you know, Constantine, obviously emperor, is part of the one percenter, and everybody wants to be close to Constantine because he's the guy that has all the power. And if he says, hey, I had this conversion experience. My mom's Christian. Lay off the Christians. Wouldn't there be a tendency for people to see that as a state endorsement and kind of start to drift that way?
Well, I mean, that's why I say there's no doubt that Christianity was going to be was going to have a privileged place in the empire, and certainly people did convert to Christianity after this, often for all the wrong reasons, you know, for purposes of networking and furthering their careers. Later church fathers like Augustine will talk about, you know, the fact that, well, you know, we've got people in the church who aren't sincere, but they're here because they think it's fashionable or something like that. So that certainly does happen. But at the same time, the other religions are not outlawed. And as Constantine put it, people should be free to be wrong. So he allowed everyone to continue worshiping according to their conscience.
Now, this has an important impact on how it changes our view of government. And it might not have seemed like that at the time. But before we address that question, so I'll leave that out there as a little bit of a teaser, I do this little counterfactual thought experiment with many of my students when it comes to the Edict of Milan. And I'm going to toss this out to you. It might be a little bit unfair because you don't write about this in your book, but had Constantine not come along in 313, or had he not converted, or had he not specifically declared the Edict of Milan, how do you think history would have played out over the next 100 years or so? Would Christianity have kept on growing? Would it have been extinguished? What do you think would have gone on?
Well, I mean, setting aside for a moment the possible miraculous nature of Constantine's conversion, because I'm the kind of person who is perfectly willing to believe in that, and there's some great stories behind that. I think, you know, we have to acknowledge that the church had all but converted the empire already before Constantine even comes on the scene. I mean, the fact that he could do what he did was because, the empire was well on its way to being converted already. And I think people make too much of Constantine the man in his role here. I mean, Constantine himself was not, you know, what we would consider a saint, although I think he is a saint for the Orthodox, but I think that, you know, put it this way, except for one person, Julian the Apostate, there were no more non-Christian or pagan emperors after Constantine. So I think the conversion was inevitable, and I think if it hadn't been Constantine, it would be someone else. It would have been someone, you know, later or, you know, just further down the road in the 4th century, and I think, the empire was just going in that direction. And, you know, you could make the case that on some level Constantine was doing what was politically expedient at that moment in history, but it doesn't change the fact that the groundwork had already been done. Constantine didn't convert the empire to Christianity. The church did, one person at a time.
I think that's a great point, and that's I share that view if I had to answer that counterfactual as well. And it really does speak to a lot of the other revolutions that you talk about in your book, is that despite persecutions, despite being on a playing field that is tilted against you, Christianity and Christians kept on proselytizing. They kept on keeping on. And so people are signing on. There must have been something that really resonated with this message, this countercultural message, that people really accepted it. Let me ask you about how this changes our view of government then. So we led up to it a little bit, but it's interesting that you note that the Edict of Milan is the first historical declaration of religious freedom. And this is, you know, maybe only one small part of looking at governance or the state or government, but it can be a pretty important influential one. I mean, the Roman Empire continues with a lot of autocratic rulers, so it wasn't a major revolution of the way we consider government. But how does Christianity impact the view of government from this point on?
Well, I think, you know, we already have the precedent in Judaism of, you know, kings having to acknowledge that they're not above the law, that believing in a higher power means that there is a higher law. And so Constantine himself wasn't necessarily doing anything new in that regard. In fact, in some ways, he fell short of it. But what this, you know, Constantinian revolution did was show the world a way of doing government in which the person at the top of the pyramid is not really at the top of the pyramid, and that person is a steward for a higher power. And so the way that Christianity changes our notion of government is to talk about government or leadership as stewardship or as servanthood. And hopefully leaders are supposed to remember that they answer to God, and also that they work for the people, not for themselves and their peers. And I think, you know, in many ways, our leaders forget that. They forget that they work for us and that they answer to God. But that is kind of the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. Whenever I meet politicians, I kind of remind them of that, and they give me the old chuckle. Mm-hmm. But that's a very good point. One of the nice things that you do in this chapter, and it's a little bit different than some of the other chapters, but you jettison forward a little bit in history to the United States, you know, circa 1776, circa 1788, 1789. How do you make that connection with the United States here?
Well, I think that, you know, even though sort of Constantine's Camelot, if you will, was short-lived, and, you know, before the end of the 4th century, there was a real marriage of church and state in the sense that, you know, Christianity was the official religion of the Roman Empire, and, you know, by the time of Theodosius in the year 380, paganism is outlawed. So the Constantinian experiment was short-lived, but our government, in some ways, in the way it was created and founded, inherited some of the better aspects of what was envisioned at that time. So we have some very good things built into our government if our leaders will submit themselves to that.
Yeah, and I like that part of the book, and you kind of see we had to reinvent this, because one of the problems that occurs is that after the playing field is leveled in the Edict of Milan, you document over the course of roughly about maybe three-quarters of a century to a century or so, the church does become the official church, and the Christian church aligning itself with many temporal powers does not necessarily have the greatest history in the world. But what's the nice thing that you point out in your book, and this relates to another of the seven revolutions, is that the revolution of the state and Christianity being Christian philosophy being injected into our understanding of government is not the be-all and end-all. There's actually other places that we engage in social relations that the Christian church has had a big influence here. And this is one of the other chapters that you wrote, and that is with the idea of community. And explain what is going on in the revolution of community.
Well, the revolution of community is, as I see it, a function of the fact that, you know, if God is love, and then, you know, the sort of corollary to that is that we are to love our neighbor. And if you remember the parable of the Good Samaritan that Jesus tells, that whole parable starts with somebody asking him the question, well, who's my neighbor? And there's a sort of an expectation that the person wants Jesus to say, well, people like you, people who live near you, people who look like you, people who sound like you. But that's not what Jesus says, right? Jesus basically says, there is no one who is not your neighbor. Everyone is your neighbor. And so the revolution of community is, that we as a people are meant to be inclusive. We're meant to be engaged with our neighbors. We're meant to be respectful of all people, regardless of whether they're like us or not. And I connect that in the book to some historical context where there were people who wanted to turn the church into something that was going to be exclusive, that was going to kick people out for not measuring up. And folks like St. Augustine were there to say no. That's not what the church is meant to be. The church is meant to be inclusive, and so I extrapolate that to, our world as well, that we as people are meant to be inclusive. And that has implications for things like immigration and other aspects of how we live in community.
Yeah, the story of the Good Samaritan is really important here, too, because the Samaritans in the pre-Jesus world were neighbors in that they were kind of close to you, but they were not neighbors in that nobody liked them.
And, right, because they were seen as different, the other.
Yeah, and so bringing folks in. And for me, this was a great chapter as well, because I read this temporally in the book before the chapter on the state, the revolution of the state. And so I'm taking these a little bit out of order in the book. But, you know, one of the things that I note, well, if things go wrong up there in the government and, you start to get exclusivity and some problems there, you always have the role of community, and that the church has a very strong idea of governance, not necessarily government, but governance amongst the community in and of itself. And I couldn't help thinking about the Catholic concept of subsidiarity throughout this entire chapter. And so I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, I think there's several things going on here. And this is where it starts to get real close to sort of the end of the book, where we also talk about, what people can do. You know, remember, the book is called Christianity Changed the World and Can Change It Again. So I think that, part of it is that, we're increasingly living in a world where we're isolated from each other. And increasingly we don't really know our neighbors very well. And one of the things we sort of critique in the book is this trend of people shopping for a church and driving miles and miles and miles to a mega church or someplace like that, passing by several perfectly good churches on the way and getting involved in a church that's not even in their community, when it might be a better idea to get involved in their community, meet their neighbors, and be engaged in the place where they live, which I suppose is the Catholic idea of the parish, right? So on that level, I think it's good. It's important for people to form relationships with people and to get out there and meet people and be involved in the community. And then there are other levels of community as well. So we encourage people to get to know their representatives, their government representatives, and really talk to them and make their wishes and values known, so that the representatives can be encouraged to, vote according to, what the people want, as opposed to just what's good for them or their peers. And then another level of community is and this is a tricky one, is social media. And we don't necessarily say social media is a bad thing, although it can, if we're not careful, only make the isolation worse. But on the other hand, there's a lot of, negativity going on social media, and so we encourage people to be vocal and stand up for the church and for the faith on social media, and to show people that, we're out here, and that they can't sort of assume that everyone is against the church and against Christianity.
This brings me back to some of the other chapters. And one of the things that I like about your book is that each of these seven revolutions that you talk about Christianity promoting in history at this point in time are not isolated from one another. They're connected. And you mentioned early on, you build from the individual and go upwards in concentric circles. I threw you a curve here, and we started at religion and then jumped up to the state and back to community. And those are the chapters that you were involved in writing the most in, although you had some feedback back and forth with your co-author. But I would like you to address a few of the other chapters, and you can kind of do this as a lump sum, some of the chapters that Mike wrote in the book, which I think are also very foundational and revolutionary in the way that Christianity looked at the human person. And this deals with the revolution of the person or the individual, the revolution of the home, of the role of different individuals in the home, including the different genders, including children versus parents, and then also of labor or of work. So if you want to talk about those three things and why or what Christianity did to revolutionize our thinking on this and how that has been important, give us a go at that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that can be sort of lumped together into this concept of a person's value, a person's worth. And that is that, you know, what Christianity converted the world to was the realization that a person's value is not based on what that person can contribute or whether that person is a burden on other people. And so the Roman concept of value is entirely based on what people contribute, and of course some people were property, and so Christianity critiques that, and so the concept of the value of the individual in the Roman world was almost non-existent, except to the extent that that individual can do something for, you know, the larger group. And, you know, it, of course, we see that some individuals, their value was simply as entertainment. Prostitution is legal. The gladiator games, the gladiators in the arena fight to the death often. And so, you know, people can be valued simply for entertainment, and they can even be disposable when that entertainment is done. It even goes to the extent that if someone is humiliated or if someone is an embarrassment to their family, they're expected to commit suicide so that they won't be an embarrassment to their family. So the concept of being a burden on someone else is even extended to embarrassment. And I think that we're seeing a lot of these things, you know, come back around today with assisted suicide, euthanasia, and, you know, the brutal blood sports that make pain and suffering into entertainment. And even with some reality television that makes humiliation into entertainment as people sell their own privacy to put their lives on television for the entertainment of others. And so, you know, all of these kinds of things are what the church critiqued, and the church gave the world a new way of looking at the individual. The individual is made in the image of God, and so an individual is valued simply because they're made in the image of God, and simply because they're a human being, and not based on anything else. And this is really the beginning of what we call human rights. I mean, before Christianity came along, there was no such thing as human rights.
Yeah, I think that's very important. And you actually, in the book, do this in a way that is very stark, so to speak, that you tell stories of how the Romans actually devalued human life to the extent that infanticide was so common that the archaeologists have unearthed aqueducts that have been clogged with the bones of small children, where people are just, you know, I don't want this kid, he's a little bit deformed, or I would rather have a boy than a female, and so let's just toss the kid in a ditch and be done with that. And it's relatively horrifying to read that and then to think about what Christianity does in terms of revolutionizing that concept of the human person.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was all perfectly legal. People could you know, just on a whim, they could take their newborn and just put it out on the garbage dump to be, you know, eaten by animals or picked up and brought into slavery. And the church stepped up. I mean, the church not only critiqued these practices, but the church went out and picked up these babies and adopted them and raised them.
And one of the other things, too, is that this not only has an effect on just individual persons, but gender roles as well. And that's a big part of the revolution of the home that goes on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, we have that passage from Paul in Galatians where he says, "There, you know, now that we're in Christ, there is no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female." And while some of the things that Paul wrote may seem behind the times from our perspective, I'm thinking of Ephesians 5 and some of these other things. They were actually quite ahead of their time at that time, and in his own way, Paul was advocating for an equality of the sexes and a mutual respect between a husband and wife as partners. And the church really took that and ran with it. And in a world where marriage was a contract meant to do nothing really more than consolidate wealth and, you know, make sure the so-called right people inherited the money. You know, most people couldn't get a legal marriage if they had wanted one, and most people didn't bother. And yet, Christianity affirmed the holiness of marriage within that context and supported it, and supported the home as a place where, you know, husband and wife were partners and where the family was a safe place for everyone involved.
Let me spin us up to the present time, and we've already touched upon this. You've mentioned things about social media and encroaching of policies that legalize euthanasia. But bring it up to the modern world. And this is one of the nice things you've done. We've covered most of these seven revolutions. I don't think we covered the revolution in terms of death, but I will leave that to folks to pick up your book and read. But bringing this up to the modern world, I thought was an ingenious way to wrap history around and to allow us to think about the lessons of the past and what Christianity did for the world in those first, you know, few hundred years by introducing all these new ways of thinking about individuals, of the home, of the state, etc. And you talk about how Christianity can still be important for the modern era. In fact, that is, you know, in the subtitle of your book here, is that how Christianity changed the world and can change it again. You talk about something known as the post-Christian era or post-Christian age. I guess some people might call it the secular age. What do you mean by this, and is this really something unique in our world today?
Yes. Well, okay, so the post-Christian age is our observation that the influence that the church once had on the world is waning. And this, in one sense, it really isn't anything new, because for centuries, people have been bemoaning the fact that, you know, that the church's influence on the world is declining. What I think is different now, or perhaps a bit newer, is that this isn't just about, you know, complaining that people, individuals, are ignoring the church's morals, but this is more about seeing a shift in the culture in which the institutions of the culture, and especially the government, are no longer supporting the church's morals. And so, in other words, we have a shift from Christianity influencing the culture to a secular culture even forcing itself on people of faith. You know, one of the complaints you often hear is that you know, people want to say they don't want a religion to, you know, to force its morals on everyone else. We're actually moving into a time when we're seeing the world forcing its morals or lack thereof on people of faith. Examples would be a healthcare mandate that forces Christians to pay for abortions, regulating church organizations you know, like Catholic Charities or something, and forcing them to either operate outside of their own convictions or go out of business. Laws and lawsuits that are forcing small mom-and-pop shops to operate their business against their beliefs or go out of business. And so what we're seeing here are subtle forms of persecution from the government, from academia, from other institutions, and forcing Christians to sort of make that age-old choice between Christ or Caesar, between church and government. And in that sense, it looks a lot like the pre-Christian world in which, you know, the world before Christianity converted the Roman Empire. So it looks, so the post-Christian world looks a lot like the world in which Christianity was persecuted originally. The good news is, though, that it was a persecuted church that converted the world, and so we can certainly do it again.
I want to hold off on how that can actually happen, but come back to a statement that you made earlier, talking about how Romans glorified violence, and you know, there was somewhat of almost a death cult, and then you connected that as well with our modern times of the glorification of violent sports, and I couldn't help but thinking of, you know, mixed martial arts here, or possibly football, and I just have to note because I have a black belt in martial arts, as I believe you do. stuff like mixed martial arts. I mean, there's actually a big, huge Christian influence in a big sector of MMA. How do you reconcile that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you're right. I have been practicing martial arts for most of my life, and we have a footnote in the book where we say, we're not talking about the practice of martial arts, and we're not saying that, the practice of martial arts is inherently wrong. We think that, that can certainly be good for people in terms of being physically fit and discipline, and, there's all kinds of good side effects of the practice of martial arts and the practice of sports, even, in football, even contact sports. So we're not really critiquing all of that, but we are critiquing the extent to which, some MMA goes in what we might call ultimate fighting. And because I am a bit concerned about the ways in which some of those fights go to the extreme that a person could be seriously injured or killed in one of those combats, and it's simply for the sake of entertainment. And of course, those guys are doing it because at that level, this is what they do for a living, and there's a salary involved, and so can't necessarily blame them for that completely. But I am concerned about the way in which violence is used as entertainment at that level. So
it's part of this whole, I guess, YouTube fight club mentality. Is, oh, I can do this on YouTube as well. And you got, two kids in the backyard pounding on each other. But you also, and I thought this was a really great observation, talk about it not just only in physical violence, but psychological and emotional and spiritual violence in terms of the glorification of humiliation in a lot of these reality shows that we see today. And I've never been a big fan of reality shows because I do think it incentivizes people just to, be the most idiotic that they possibly can and cruel. So, speak to that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I don't claim to be an expert on reality television because I don't watch a lot of it. I have seen enough to know that there are these reality television shows where groups of people are thrown together because they are of the same social class and live in the same city, and they don't like each other. They claim to be friends, but they're really only together because they're being paid. They're paid quite a hefty sum per episode. So they're drawn in by the money, and then it becomes almost to the point where they can't get out, because if they leave the show, they leave that huge salary behind. But as long as they're on the show, they're creating drama for themselves because they're forced to interact with these people that, they're all hateful to each other. And they're just creating misery for themselves, misery on top of misery and drama and, they're always fighting and crying, and here people are watching that as entertainment. And I'm very concerned about the effect that will have on society as a whole, because we as humans tend to imitate what we watch, and I think I worry that people will get the idea that it's acceptable to behave like that in real life.
Yeah, it's that backtracking on the revolution of the person, of the devaluing the person and seeing them as merely an object for our gratification rather than a individual child of God oneself. And that part of the book really did resonate with me. And it also made me rather, pessimistic about the world. So this was part of the downer about the book. When you're writing about the post-Christian era, I'm like, oh, boy, things are horrible here. But there's some sunshine in this book, right? In the subtitle, as I mentioned before, How Christianity Can Change It Again. Give us the optimistic sunny side. What is Christianity dead, or is there a chance for revival?
Well, I definitely think there is a chance for revival. I think Christianity is, continually going through revival and continually reviving the world where it has influence. I think right now we're at an important point in history that, if people do speak up and get involved, if people know their history and defend the faith and what it stands for, I think we can bring some sanity back into the world. Sometimes it is easy to sort of get down and feel like, well, the world is going in this direction, but there's nothing I can do. But there are things we can do. And I am basically an optimistic person, and even though I sort of have a realistic view of original sin, I think, you know, that humans are flawed. But humans are worth caring for and loving and even, you know, fighting for in that sense. And I think that that we have to live on hope. We have to live on hope and gratitude. And if we do that, and if we engage with people and get involved and create relationships and sort of reject the isolationism that you know, if we're not careful, could come from that feeling of despair, if we really engage, we can definitely change the world, at least in our circles and, you know, one person at a time.
Yeah. Again, and you leave off with that, and the possibility of revival is always there. And throughout history, there's been many times that have looked pretty dark and grim. And I think one of the things that you just mentioned, if as long as people know their history, they can understand that dark times do not last forever. Rainstorms don't always last forever, and so it's possible to revive. Do you think anything, you know, from your vantage point? What the institutional church could do, and this includes the Catholic Church, Protestant churches, and including other forms of faith as well, Judaism and other faiths. What do you think is important for these institutional forms of religion to do in order to re-engage the world?
Well, that's a great question, and I am passionate about many things, one of which is ecumenical dialogue and working together across denominational boundaries. And so I think one of the things that the institutional churches can do, and they are doing it, is to reach out to each other, work together. And so if there is a community that, you know, has multiple churches of different denominations, those churches ought to be working together, and of course in many cases they already are, working together to change the world in these ways. And sort of use each other's strengths as gifts, you know. So that would be one thing that I would say that you know we want to reach out across denominational boundaries and really try and work together and affirm each other.
Well, that is a pretty good idea, and one of the things that we try to do here on Research on Religion is to share a number of different perspectives on this and to be ecumenical and also to think about our history as well, which is one of the things that you do really fabulously in this book. And again, I recommend people pick up your book. It is called 7 Revolutions, How Christianity Changed the World and Can Change It Again. And Jim, I want to thank you once again for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.